You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, September 9th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Atlantic contributing editor Steve Clements on the Iran deal and why 41 is so much different than 34. Also on Hillary Clinton's foreign policy address at Brookings today. Also on the program, yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's not quite official, but it is in my mind. I mean, it's been in my mind for almost 2 years, probably. But I would say, let me put it this way. If Trade Sports still existed, I would head over to Trade Sports right now and place bets that Chris Christie is far more likely to be en route to prison in December of 2016 than he is to the White House, or even, frankly, back to the State House in New Jersey. I will explain why in a bit. Also on the program today, 80% of people in South Carolina, or I should say Republican voters, want Lindsey Graham to quit the race. And so Rick Perry is just about quitting the race.
How dare you? The nerve.
If I quit
the race, Iran will take over Charleston.
I was going to say, and Graham gets that polling data and immediately calls for a ground invasion of Syria and actually any Arab country in North Africa.
That polling looks bad. Bomb Morocco.
Also on the program today, we will get to that paid sick leave. We're going to spend a lot of time on this Christie thing. I'm going to give you the full background, and it is just fantastic. All that and more. Like I say, if only Trade Sports was around, I would be placing that bet about Christie. However, it is opening week of the NFL regular season, and it's the last chance you have to join FanDuel before the opening weekend. There has been an explosion of fantasy football. Literally, I said this yesterday, but again last night, a buddy of mine told me that he also does fantasy football. And you know who else? Grant, who came in, who was working on a show that we're going to be launching soon. There'll be more on that later. But FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football, more winners and payouts than any other site. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. Building a team is easy. Just pick your players, stay under the salary cap, sit back on Sunday, watch your team win. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. So go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use my code MAJOR, and sign up now. You get a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR, as in Majority Report. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel, FanDuel.com. Sign up today. All right, we're going to take a quick break and talk to Steve Clemens. He's on a train. He just sat through that speech. I don't mean to make it sound like he said, like, no, he was in the room, heard Hillary Clinton's speech, is headed back on a train. Hopefully, we will have good reception. You know how these things go. So we'll give it a try. We'll be right back in just a moment with Steve Clemens. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program the Washington editor-at-large of The Atlantic magazine, Steve Clemens. Steve, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Sam, and excuse the fascinating sounds of the Amtrak that I'm on right now.
Not at all. I have told people that you're actually just heading back. I know that you were at the Brookings Institute listening to Hillary Clinton's speech, where she came out very strongly for the Iran deal. But you had some critique, and I want to get to that in a moment. But first, one of the things I think has been sort of confusing for people on this whole Iran agreement is really two things. Why is the dynamic such that the Congress has to almost vote to prevent the president from engaging in this agreement? And then why is the number 34 not as good as the number 41?
Well, two great questions. I mean, the second question first, the difference between 34 votes and 41 votes is that at 34 votes, the president is protected. The deal will survive if both houses of Congress vote to disapprove the Iran deal. The president simply vetoes it, and they will not be able to override his veto. So the president wins the argument. If 41 votes are held and all 41 of those votes are not only in favor of the Iran deal, but are strongly in favor such that they want to preempt the Senate from even taking this up, they have the ability either through two directions. One is to filibuster and prevent, achieving cloture in a vote. That has been, one avenue that can go down. The other is a more interesting one, is that there is a dispute right now between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell about the rules under which this would be voted up or down. And under the rules, which Ben Cardin, who is against the deal, but Ben Cardin, Bob Corker, others there, when they basically got the deal for the United States Senate to play a role and to be considered as relevant in this Iran deal discussion, is everyone's understanding at that time back in April was it would require 60 votes to pass. And Right now, at 41 votes, the Republicans don't have 60 votes. So Mitch McConnell is trying to rewrite history and basically have a 50-vote margin, when, in fact, whenever the Republicans have done this, it's always been a 60-vote requirement. So there's a filibuster possibility, but there's also the rules that they agreed to in April, which most people concur required a 60-vote issue. So if that 41 votes is vital in either of two of those cases, we don't know how this is going to play out. It's a very, you know, nasty dogfight right now over what the rules by which this will be brought up will be. But there's a possibility that the United States Senate will not pass the resolution of disapproval on the Iran deal. That's what is so interesting here.
And I want to get to that just sort of first, that first question as to why it's disapproval as opposed to approval. But what's embedded in all of this conversation, it seems to me, is, and this is something, this is why I wanted to talk to you about it, because, look, at the end of the day, I should say, the if the president vetoes this, the agreement goes forward. If the Democrats filibuster this with 41 votes, the deal goes forward. If McConnell upholds the deal that was made in committee, the deal goes forward. What is the difference, though, in terms of the way this is projected outward? Because that's what we're all, that's what all this drama is about, right? Is like,
right. That's absolutely right. The drama is important in the eyes of many. It's important how this plays in Iran, which is having its own parliamentary debate. There are enemies of this deal inside Iran who think it gives too much power to the United States. I was listening to a debate 2 days ago, or discussion with Ali Larijani, the Speaker of the House in the Iranian Parliament, you know, who was saying, look, you know, if we are perceived to misbehave, sanctions bounce back. But we don't get to bounce back, you know, the core of the nuclear reactor that we're going to pour cement into. We don't get to pour back the capacity that we're giving up from their perspective. So while it may be a leap for people to understand it there, there is another debate going on somewhere else. And also, I think, for the two houses of the United States Congress to vote definitively, essentially, against the deal, and you raise a very good point, you know, the Senate is all, you know, it's full of double negatives, sometimes they come out as positive. But the reason that this is a resolution of disapproval of the deal is that this is an affirmative international arrangement which the president is agreeing to, which the United Nations Security Council voted for 15 to nothing. It's already in play. And normally, this is not, normally this kind of arrangement would never go to the Senate or to the House for consideration and a vote like this. It's a highly unusual arrangement that the executive made with Congress to give them a role, to give them a voice. Nor, this is not a treaty. This doesn't, you know, need to be ratified. So the president and Senator Corker and others came to an agreement that he would, in fact, work with the United States Congress to give them a role and voice in doing this, but it's not a usual way. So the way they came out to deal with it, the deal they have is the president is going to proceed with all the authorities that he has to move forward with an international agreement. And if the Congress wants to preempt it, then they have to disapprove it. But what right now the White House is trying to stop that blotch on this treaty that would ride into history, that the president only got the deal because of his executive power and his ability to override many, many voices. It would be much better for history, much better for the Obama legacy, and frankly, much better for the international terrain of this if the Congress failed to coalesce, or is a negative voice on the Iran deal.
That part of it is fascinating to me because, like you say, the president has authority under the statutes that basically allowed him to impose sanctions, to revoke those sanctions unilaterally. And so what it's almost as if, I mean, basically what the president is seeking here is a begrudging or a less begrudging acquiescence from Congress rather than, just as a way to sort of solidify like we're unified. And the process sort of dictates that. It's not just the outcome. It's actually the process. So let me ask you this. Is there value when you have like you said, the in the parliament in Iran, there are officials arguing, hey, this isn't a good deal for us. Is there value for the process and for the sort of the agreement, the success of the agreement, to actually have reluctance in this country to make it look like, you know, hey, we're not so happy with the deal either? In other words, if tomorrow all of Congress said, yeah, this is a great deal for America, and would that not sort of cause problems for those who support the deal in Iran?
To a certain degree, I think that that is right. If we were overjoyed, look, I think, you know, after Lausanne at the end of April, many of us looked at the deal and I said, wow, Iran agreed to that. We were very, very surprised that Iran at the last minute caved on so many different issues. And many of us were saying at the time that the president's negotiating team did much better. You had people like the French saying, well, we could have gotten more at that time because the Iranians caving in last minute showed how much they wanted the deal. So, yeah, those optics can matter, you know, at the fringe. At the end of the day, you have to have a deal that stands up to scrutiny across the P5 plus one countries plus Iran. And then, you know, other nations around the world that care as well that are stakeholders in this. And that's a very, very hard deal because you're never going to get a deal that hits all of, you know, everyone's highest preference points. But yeah, if we had been overwhelmingly, you know, if we ran a Mission Impossible, a Mission Accomplished banner behind Barack Obama when he announced this deal, that would have probably created a pushback in Iran. And so to a certain degree, the consternation has been useful, but there's a point where it becomes reckless and damaging. So balanced skepticism. You know, today Hillary Clinton was, you know, saying, I, you know, don't trust and verify. I understand that. Donald Trump, you know, has said the same thing. He said he wouldn't rip up the deal, but he would lawyer the heck out of it. That's exactly the right position. You shouldn't have to build an arrangement like this based on, you know, trust of Iran. But at the same time, you need to have a kind of constructive engagement with this process. What's really been alarming to me is that people like Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft, particularly Brent Scowcroft, who is, you know, Jeb Bush's dad's best friend in the entire world, have written that this was an epical decision, one of the most important foreign policy decisions of this era. And yet you've got in, you know, almost, you know, gridlocked Republican opposition to this deal. It's so political and so partisan. And it reminds me of the days when we used to critique, you know, communist Soviet Union or communist China, where parties dictated how people thought, not logic, not empiricism, not looking at arrangements. And, you know, we all ought to be worried about that, that when parties become the ones that dictate truth and positions and posture more than what you're seeing empirically, it can be very damaging.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, there's a lot of people who have staked their careers on maintaining a threat, maintaining Iran as a threat, frankly. And I think, you know, we're seeing a little bit of that panic. What you were critiquing, you mentioned Clinton's speech today. You were critiquing it a bit en route to the train. Tell me, I mean, I get the, I mean, I have a sense of what that critique is, because this Iran deal is a fundamental shift in some ways. Explain that and why you think that Clinton isn't sort of, my sense is from your tweets that you feel that Clinton isn't really sort of leaning forward, I guess, into this sort of fundamental shift.
Well, that is one of the dangers in asking a prolonged question to someone who is on a train, because they could go into a tunnel. I'm going to try and ring him back, but it's quite possible we have heard all we can hear from Steve Clemens today on this. But 5 minutes of Steve Clemens is like 20 minutes of any other person. So we really got close to 30 minutes of. Let me just try Steve one more time. Okay, folks, we can't reach Steve Clemens again. But, I think, we can have him on to talk in the future about that. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I can tell you that with his tweet was something to the effect that I had set up there with that protracted question regarding Hillary Clinton sort of saying, and I can tell you what I'm reading about that that speech that she gave at the Brookings Institute. I too am deeply concerned about Iranian aggression and need to confront it. I mean, remember, this deal was never structured to address just about anything else Iran was doing in the region. In fact, it was never structured or meant to address anything that Iran was doing in the region, but to focus exclusively on its nuclear program. And so it's not surprising to some extent. In fact, it's very consistent with who I think Hillary Clinton is to hear her say, "I am deeply concerned about Iranian aggression and need to confront it. There's absolutely no reason to trust Iran. Her approach to dealing with Iran's nuclear program would be distrust, but verify. I don't see Iran as our partner in implementing the agreement. I see Iran as our subject in implementing the agreement. I will not hesitate to take military action if Iran attempts to obtain a nuclear weapon." She introduced a 5-point plan focused on building regional alliances to counter what Iran's bad behavior in the region, which she called. So that alliance would include going back into time and not invading Iraq, would be my guess, but let me save some of my editorial. This will include continued military aid to Israel in particular and to the U.S. Gulf allies, along with steps to counter growing Iranian influence in the Middle East, particularly through proxy groups like Hezbollah. She will also emphasize the need to crack down on Iranian human rights abuses, which honestly is just laughable. Because, of course, you're going to do that by exerting pressure through governments like Saudi Arabia, who like to chop off the arms of people who, I don't know, steal stuff. She will emphasize, yes, and leave the door open to broadening sanctions on the regime. So, again, I don't want to characterize Steve's criticism because I've only just read his tweets. But I think there are many who see this Iran deal as a fundamental shift in the way that we deal with conflict. Now, that may be overstating things, but I think, and particularly for those of us who are sort of lay people, but I think within the foreign policy establishment, they see this, our foreign policy, as a sort of like a battle carrier, maybe pun intended, and even a slight shift in the direction in which it's heading is very, very significant. And an agreement here could theoretically lead to other agreements. And in many respects, I'm not convinced that's not why you see such howling from the neocons. Because their number one agenda is not, in my estimation, security or peace for other Middle East entities or around the world or even Israel, but rather regime change so that there can be more hegemony over that region. And
you know, warming relations, lukewarm relations is sort of the worst case scenario for these people. Because you don't have that sense of existential threat that allows them to demagogue and to gin up a war. But you also don't have the ability to sit on the board of directors of a country, essentially, and all that that entails. So I think someone like Clemens would have liked to see not just the strong endorsement for this deal, but for a strong endorsement for the strategic underpinnings of this deal. And I don't want to say ideological, that may be too strong of a word, but for the foreign policy perspective that underpins this deal. In other words, lead forcefully with negotiations as opposed to military might. And it doesn't sound like her speech reflected that. You know, I'm not terribly surprised that I don't know what is in Hillary Clinton's heart. It doesn't really matter. The bottom line is that she has to assume a posture, or she assumes a posture that she thinks is going to be politically most advantageous for her. And I imagine part of that calculation, I mean, part of it just could be the case, but I also imagine part of that calculation is a sense of we're not going to be punished by the Democratic constituency for being slightly overly aggressive or muscular when it comes to foreign policy. But as a Democrat and a woman, I need to project that I'm willing to attack a country as readily as John McCain would. And I don't think she's done that, because, of course, John McCain is against this deal. And Lindsey Graham not only is against this deal, but is really, I think, upset that we're not starting a ground war right now.
If we could just bomb the Ayatollah, I'd feel so much better.
I mean, I think we would all
sleep. My old schoolhouse is going to become a mosque now. Thank you, Obama.
So,
John McCain is so dreamy.
Let me read what Steve Clemens' tweet was. Though supports Iran deal, Hillary Clinton giving neocon influence speech at Brookings foreign policy. So negative, out of step with Obama achievement. And so, you know, that's that.
And but, I think, and Steve has been someone who I think has, who likes Hillary Clinton. Like, that's not coming from someone who has any hostile agenda towards her at all. So that's
no,
striking.
I suspect that's coming out of a certain amount of disappointment.
Yeah, definitely.
And
but I'm saying it's not a predetermined, it's not like a priori disappointment with her and her policy. Like, he's very fair to her. So
I definitely think so. And you know, the Obama was, I think, felt that he had room in foreign policy that Hillary Clinton doesn't have, partly because it was very hard to argue that we should have more war in 2008. And partly, I think, because in his mind, you know, my middle name's Hussein. I'm not going to convince them. So who knows what is in Hillary Clinton's heart, but what she's signaling now is a little bit more rigid, I think, than people would like. But take that what it's worth. I don't know if we've heard a major foreign policy speech yet from Bernie Sanders. And I don't know how much Joe Biden's sort of nibbling at the edges here
impacts Clinton's perspective as well. All right, let me briefly go into this. Should we do our Teaser Tuesday today? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
Folks, this show relies on your support for its continued existence. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, you can support this show by going and checking out the sponsors that we have. If you're listening to the free show, we occasionally will have an ad. Sometimes we'll try and do one a cycle for members, just because maybe members are interested in a deal. But no, that's not. I mean,
it's Trump.
I had member tell me that they were glad that I included the Casper mattress one, because they had to buy their kid a mattress for college, and this they could just do from their computer. Yeah. Boom.
Boom.
But so occasionally we include them in the fans, and we're on a streak right now. We've had more ads in the past, I think, 8 days than we did in the past, like, 8 weeks. But that's not going to last. And so right now we're at 98.3% of our revenue coming from members. Usually we're at 99.6%. And those numbers have not been verified, I should tell you, because no one in here knows even how to work a calculator. You can also support this program by getting your coffee from justcoffee.coop, C-O-O-P. And this is a 100% deal. Well, actually, you get 10% off if you use the coupon code MAJORITY. But you get 100% satisfaction, because you can get all sorts of different coffee. You can buy the Majority Report blend, which is sort of like an advertisement for the show. And it's so good that Rev Coffee Shop up in Hudson serves it as their house coffee. Still, like, on a buzz about that. And everybody gets a fair trade, a fair wage throughout the entire process. So, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Give us a review on iTunes, majority.fm/review. Just give us a rating, for gosh sakes. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program, ladies and gentlemen. You can also IM me via the app, which I'm turning on right now. I forgot to do that before. Sorry. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.